this misconception. Labels as answers, inflammation as cause, metabolism myth, gene blame game, ignoring the unforgiving four, it's all in your head. You created your illness. These are mistakes that cause widespread suffering, take away your choice, freedom and rights, and leave you feeling like you're to blame. These are mistakes that are not owned up to and acknowledged, where you don't get to call in the manager and ask her to go back and double check for you. After applying a great mistake to you, no one returns later admitting they had been looking in the wrong place for an answer. Nor are the great mistakes recalled, as they should be, like a batch of ground beef found to be contaminated with E. coli. "We're sorry," the announcement would go. "These ideas are not safe to consume. Return them for a full refund of your mental health." Have you ever been sharing the story of your thyroid woes with others, and that look comes into their eyes that means they're not quite with you anymore? Whether it's the first time you've told your story to them, or the umpteenth update, there's a subtle or not-so-subtle skepticism that can creep into the mind of someone who's trying to bear witness to a friend, patient, or loved one dealing with chronic illness. It's skepticism that's born out of the great mistakes clouding their thoughts. Why hasn't this person gotten better with so many answers available to them? These people wonder. And instead of the next thought being, "There must be something wrong with the information," they think, "There must be something wrong with this person." This kind of thinking can start to creep into your own mind with any symptom or condition you're dealing with, and it can be so destructive. You already know on some level, however deeply you've had to bury this knowing, that you're not doing anything wrong, and that the great mistakes aren't answers. You've already lived through several, if not all of them. If they were answers, you wouldn't still be searching for the path to health. There are no fingers to point in the misguided theories of chronic illness. As I said, we all make mistakes, and we've all had experiences of unknowingly carrying out mistakes that were not our own. The true mark of progress is not how few wrong turns we make, it's how deftly we correct course when we learn we've been going in the wrong direction. In order to correct course, we really need to know what went wrong. We need to be able to point to the map and say, "See? This is how far away we are from where we meant to go. These are the spots where we misread the road signs." Otherwise, how do we find the right path? Mostly, the great mistakes have been the result of medical denial. And like all denial, this gets in the way of progress. It upholds an illusion of functionality, when meanwhile, things are falling apart. People dealing with the reality of chronic illness feel disposable, crumpled up and thrown away like dirty tissues. It may be uncomfortable to face this reality. That's okay. It's far, far better to feel some discomfort about the truth than to repeat these mistakes for the next 50 years, which is what's bound to happen unless these truths surface. If you need another reference point for the great mistakes, just think of the Great Lakes, which were so polluted by the 1960s that Lake Erie was pronounced to be dying. This was another tragedy caused by human error. Eventually, environmentalists rallied around the cause, legislation was passed, steps were taken to limit fertilizer runoff and pollutants, and life returned to the lake. In recent years, dead zones have been reported again, and people are once more calling for pollution control. We can use this story as a touchstone for the great mistakes to come. Just as the citizens of the Lake Erie watershed once made tremendous progress in bringing the lake back to life, so too can medical communities change their direction when it comes to how they view chronic conditions such as thyroid illness, if enough people rally around the cause. Course correcting for human error takes constant vigilance. We can't let appearance of improvement lull us into complacency. Just as it still takes close observation and advocacy for the truth to keep the lake's best interest in the public eye, we can all keep our eye out for one another to ensure that progress remains forward moving. Out of antiquity. To get perspective on today's great mistakes of chronic illness, we must keep in mind that one day we'll look back at the present as a moment in history. Science's hallmark is that its study develops over time to allow for a deeper, richer, truer understanding of our world. New experiments improve upon old ones, clear insights replace mistaken hypotheses, advancements that went in the wrong direction for the wrong reasons get reeled back in and redirected. So what may seem like the forefront of rational thought today could one day be considered out of date as new facts come to light. This is the perspective we must bring to analyzing modern-day medical theories. Some will stand the test of time, others won't. Take, for example, the time when tonsillectomies first drew favor. Many children began presenting with tonsillitis, and the prevailing wisdom became that the tonsils should be removed. It became such dominant thinking that no one even thought to question whether the cause of tonsillitis in the first place could be addressed instead. The focus on the medical advancement of the tonsillectomy procedure completely buried the mystery of this widespread tonsillitis. Once tonsillectomies became commonplace, someone in medical school wouldn't be encouraged to probe the problem anymore because it had become, been there, done that. Remove the tonsils, the thinking went, and remove the problem. Why spend any more time thinking about it? Medical communities now recognize that the tonsils are tied into the immune system, and so removing them isn't the best first option when they're infected. Now antibiotics have become the favored first line of defense. This is problematic because while cofactor bacteria can further inflame the tonsils, bacteria are not the underlying cause of tonsillitis. EBV is. This whole time, it's been juvenile Epstein-Barr virus causing inflamed tonsils. In children, EBV is very difficult to diagnose because it often doesn't raise red flags that testing can detect in the bloodstream. Meanwhile, the lymphatic area where the tonsils reside can become infected as they try to fight off the virus, causing the mystery tonsil infection. It's another instance of hidden mononucleosis and the history of medical research and science being mistaken about how to solve a problem. Or consider the era when breastfeeding was discouraged. Several decades ago, breastfeeding was considered inferior to the brand new scientifically created baby formulas that were hitting the market. Women were told to stop breastfeeding because science knew better than the human body. For perspective, this happened to coincide with the time when cars didn't have headrests to prevent whiplash and seatbelts only went across the lap, and yet cars were considered advanced. Families respected this advice and regarded formula as God. Until the research surfaced years later that breast milk has untold value. The paradigm started to shift as more and more people came to realize that the human body can be trusted and that science is in fact the one lagging behind, though unfortunately this realization has stayed limited to this one area. So you get the idea about how one day we'll look back on today's medical approach to thyroid disease and other chronic illnesses from a whole new vantage point, as antiquity. In contemporary, conventional medicine, there are three main treatments for a chronic issue. Steroids, including hormone treatments, and immunosuppressants. Antibiotics, and procedures to remove the perceived problem. You might have received all three, and if one or all of them didn't make you feel better, it's very likely you got the message that you are the problem. This will one day change. The development and practice of medicine will evolve. Because the truth is, you're not the problem, and you didn't do anything wrong. The information to come about the great mistakes will show you what has been wrong all along, what type of thinking to avoid, and what pitfalls to sidestep. They will show you that you can trust yourself again, and that you can use that trust to get yourself from where you are with your health to where you want to be. Chapter 10. Great Mistake 1. Autoimmune Confusion. Even at its most basic, the autoimmune theory is misguided. That's right, the term autoimmune itself is a huge mistake. Auto comes from the Greek for self. So the word is saying that your immune system goes after you, your own self. That makes autoimmune merely a tag that puts the blame on you and your body. It's a misnomer that means we can't even talk about the truth of autoimmune disease without perpetuating the misunderstanding. A more fitting term would be viral immune, because the immune system is going after invaders. Autoimmune is not just a mistaken fixation of the conventional medical world. Alternative, functional, and integrative circles have also adopted this misconception. Why does this theory exist? Because by the 1950s, the medical world became frustrated with not having an explanation for why conditions such as Hashimoto's thyroiditis, Graves' disease, lupus, RA, Crohn's disease, celiac disease, ulcerative colitis, and MS were leaving people ailing or even crippled. Close observation of some patients' blood work revealed the presence of antibodies. An exhausting guessing game began, and the theory that best protects the medical establishment took off. It must be the body becoming confused and attacking itself. Suddenly, it turned into whisper down the lane on a global scale. Except instead of the message becoming garbled along the way, it became glorified and amplified, drowning out the undiscovered truth. Attempting to explain autoimmune issues was an honest effort at trying to give people answers. Except, unlike the cornflake story in the last chapter, no manager intervened to say, "Let's check one more time," and then, "Turns out we're looking in the wrong place." Instead, the message that autoimmune disease is the body attacking itself became law. Now the autoimmune theory is becoming a monster tsunami or a blizzard blinding everyone to the truth. It's the train barreling down the tracks at a dangerous speed, out of control. It's time to step back and reevaluate. It's time to band together and voice the truth. The theory that autoimmune disease is the body attacking itself is incorrect. The body does not attack itself. It attacks pathogens. The scientific tests to fully detect those pathogens that are causing trouble simply haven't been invented yet. Without accepting this truth, the study of autoimmune disease will not move forward in the right direction. The field will remain in a state of confusion, at the expense of all those who suffer with these debilitating symptoms. This is no half hour wasted searching for cornflakes. The consequences of not admitting this mistake will be devastating. It can ruin lives. It already has, and it will continue to into the future. You'll hear from some sources that autoimmune responses happen when your body is defending itself against a trigger, such as a pathogen or gluten, and becomes confused in the process, unable to tell the difference between a foreign presence and your own body tissue. As we looked at in the triggers chapter, This is not how triggers work. Any antibody activity is because those antibodies are going after the virus, not your own body. Remember, your body loves you unconditionally. It's also important to keep in mind that while science has advanced in its understanding of many aspects of physical function, the thyroid gland remains largely a mystery. There isn't much more medical insight into the thyroid today than there was 100 years ago, which makes it that much easier for medical communities to label thyroid conditions as autoimmune, because it's difficult to assess what's wrong with an organ or gland if the organ or gland itself is a mystery. And autoimmune is a convenient tag for, we don't know what's wrong with you, so it must be your fault. It's not doctors' fault either that any of this is the case. Doctors and other practitioners are heroes who selflessly devote their lives to helping others. They simply haven't yet been handed the best diagnostic tools or framework to determine what's truly going on with their patients who suffer from Hashimoto's, Graves, and other autoimmune diseases. Medical science is not doomed to misunderstanding autoimmune disease forever. Researchers can still make profound progress in this area and discover the secrets we're looking at in this book, if and only if they first scrap the erroneous theory behind autoimmune and begin again with a new foundation. Once medical science finally taps into the underlying truth about autoimmunity, the study and treatment of thyroid disease and other chronic illnesses will finally be able to advance. Only then will medical research uncover that the body never attacks itself. It solely goes after pathogens. Antibodies are signs that there's a virus or other antigen in the body that the immune system is putting all its energy into fighting off. This process of a pathogen invading cells creates the inflammation. Your body works to fight off that pathogen. One day, medical science will take into account that by the time a virus has started to cause chronic illness in a patient, it is usually burrowed so deep into that person's organs that the virus doesn't show up on traditional blood tests, so it appears to be a bodily malfunction. Hopefully on the sooner side, though most likely far down the road, new tests will develop to find the virus where it's hiding. Let's remember that medical science is already advancing in so many areas. It has made leaps and bounds in organ transplants, microscopic surgery and the like, areas that haven't been stymied by denial, areas where a diagnosis can be made and the next steps are clear. It's like when you take your car into the shop and the mechanic can tell from observation or computer diagnostics what's wrong. If the brakes are worn out, they can get replaced. If the starter is loose, the bolts can be tightened. When the car trouble is outside the realm of easily detectable problems, though, fixing it requires troubleshooting. This can turn into a long guessing game, unless your mechanic is really invested in getting to the bottom of it. The problem can slip through the cracks at the auto shop and you'll be back on the road again, still hearing that strange noise. Has the autoimmune label made you feel like you've slipped through the cracks of the healthcare world? Have you visited specialist after specialist, tried every alternative therapy and felt like you were a disappointment when you couldn't tell your practitioners you'd felt any improvement with their troubleshooting? Did it feel at a certain point like people gave up on you? If so, you're not alone. So many Hashimoto's and Graves' patients are told that the immune system mysteriously produces antibodies that target and damage the thyroid gland as though it were a foreign presence. This hypothesis will not hold up over time because it's not the real answer. If I went to a doctor already feeling low because I had extreme fatigue, a swollen throat and temperature sensitivity, And that doctor told me it was the result of my body becoming confused and mistaking healthy cells for intrusive ones. I would be beside myself, wondering what I did wrong to make my body go haywire. I would feel defective, broken, faulty, inadequate. Autoimmune is one of the greatest mistakes of all time. The diagnostic framework points blame in the wrong direction. It makes people think their bodies are betraying them. Once they stop trusting their bodies, they lose faith that they can heal. Now, what if you went to the doctor with those symptoms I described, and your doctor answered, "Your body is putting up an amazing fight against a virus, which has been in your system for years undetected, and has now reached an advanced stage. That inflammation in your throat is an indication that your body is warding off viral cells that are trying to cause damage to your thyroid. Your fatigue and tendency to run cold come from viral neurotoxins, taking a toll on your nerves. I know those symptoms are difficult to deal with. Take heart that they're signs your body is helping you, because remember, our bodies work for us. They protect us. They love us unconditionally. Since this is a viral issue, let's address it with natural means that will kill off that virus. Let's put you on an antiviral eating plan with lots of healing foods, herbs, and supplements to destroy the pathogen and nourish your nerves and thyroid tissue. In the meantime, if you're suffering greatly with body pain, we can always temporarily put you on an immunosuppressive drug or steroid to get you by until your healing protocol has you feeling better." Wouldn't hearing this make a tremendous difference in how you saw your illness and in your outlook for recovery? It would have the added benefit of being God's honest truth and the real way to cut through the autoimmune confusion. Chapter 11. Great Mistake 2. Mystery Illness Misconception. The great mistake of mystery illness is so dire that I wrote my entire first book about it. Here's the short version. Chronic illness is a widespread mystery. Don't be fooled by the popular belief that mystery illness is a term that merely applies to rare instances where a few kids in a remote town come down with unexplained rash and fever. A mystery illness is any ailment that leaves anyone perplexed for any reason. It doesn't matter if that ailment is named or unnamed. Hypothyroidism, Hashimoto's, Graves, hyperthyroidism, and thyroid nodules, cysts, and tumors remain just as enigmatic to modern medicine as inexplicable paralysis that has no label. If you can't visit a practitioner's office and walk away with reasonable answers and a plan that eventually heals you and doesn't just manage your symptoms, the illness is a medical mystery. Between symptoms and diseases, there are a minimum of 5,000 health issues that are still a mystery to medical science today. Acting as though migraines, depression, Lyme disease, RA, fatigue, candida, hot flashes, heart palpitations, diabetes, and so many other problems aren't baffling to experts is like ignoring the iceberg that the Titanic's about to strike. This holds true for all the great mistakes. Pretending they aren't there doesn't make them less of a hazard. People wonder why so much of the population is sick and why the cures aren't available yet. It's not because doctors are doing anything wrong. Doctors are some of the smartest, most honest people around. That's what led them to enter the health field in the first place. The trouble is that they're stuck dealing with a system that's broken and can be dishonest. One that's in denial. One that can't always admit when it doesn't have all the answers for fear this unknowing will damage its credibility. It is massively misguided to act as though chronic illnesses, such as autoimmune disease, are not mysteries to the world at large. It prevents patients from asking for answers, researchers from pursuing them and getting funding, and practitioners from being open to the information they need to help more people. In reality, the fix here would be to acknowledge how much of human health is still a mystery to science. That's what will bring the awareness and drive to find answers. Only by acknowledging the truth can we redirect course. Chapter 12. Great Mistake 3. Labels as answers. Don't even get me started on labels. So many of the names that medical science gives to chronic illnesses throw people off the path of finding real answers. As we looked at, one of the biggest is autoimmune. The name itself is wrong. When you take it to the next step and give labels to all the different autoimmune diseases, the situation gets even more out of hand. Being labeled with Hashimoto's, Graves, lupus, rheumatoid arthritis, and so on, can have a positive side. Putting a name with your symptoms can help you feel validated and can also help if your illness is very advanced and you need to be categorized as disabled to get support. When you're struggling with autoimmune disease or another chronic illness, every little bit of recognition helps. The problem is, when we look at labels as answers, as we so often do, labels make us docile. Telling a patient she or he has Addison's disease, sarcoidosis, psoriasis, alopecia, Castleman disease, endometriosis, Guillain-Barré syndrome, inflammatory bowel disease, Sjogren's syndrome, or the like, makes it seem like that's that, and it's all understood. The patient doesn't feel empowered to keep asking why, and what's the underlying cause, and do the studies on this illness seem conclusive to stand up for her or his health rights? You know how in high school labels kept everyone from looking beneath the surface? How once someone was deemed to be a burnout, deadhead, hipster, goth, freak, teacher's pet, loser, poser, liar, faker, phony, cheater, hypochondriac, sissy, wimp, prep, nerd, jock, techie, slut, emo, klepto, stoner, hippie, or so on. She or he was pigeonholed for the next 4 years. It didn't matter if you were only playing baseball because your dad was pressuring you to go after sports scholarship money, and in your spare time you wrote poetry and helped out on archaeological digs. Once people labeled you as a dumb jock, they were finished exploring your personality. It became easy to feel like maybe you really were the person they saw you as, and not the one you felt like inside. Don't let yourself be pigeonholed by a diagnosis as though this were still high school. First of all, misdiagnosis is rampant in chronic illness. Because these conditions are a mystery and often outside the scope of testing, it often comes down to a practitioner's observation to give you a name for your suffering. That name can be a mistake. Secondly, the names behind diagnoses don't hold much weight. After all, what's Hashimoto's thyroiditis telling us? That a man by the name of Hashimoto observed some thyroids that were inflamed. That's all. Itis means inflammation. He made those observations in the early 1900s, by the way, by feeling inflamed thyroids with his hands, a practice that was actually very helpful for getting in touch with the patient's symptoms and has now fallen out of favor. 100 years later, we are still in the dark ages when it comes to how to alleviate the underlying cause of Hashimoto's. Unless you've heard the detailed information in this audiobook, or in the Hypothyroidism and Hashimoto's Thyroiditis chapter of Medical Medium, that's where the explanation was revealed for the first time. If you've been given a label for your chronic health struggles and that label makes you feel any level of despair, take heart that you haven't been handed the full reason for your suffering. When you're given the real reason for why you're not feeling your best, not just a name for your limitations, hopelessness disappears because knowing what's wrong is the first step in healing. Chapter 13. Great Mistake 4. Inflammation as cause. Inflammation is its own label that gets thrown around too liberally. You see inflammation deemed to be the cause of everything from cancer to obesity to heart disease, and it's a huge topic in thyroid illness and autoimmune disease. Everywhere you turn, supplements and health foods are being advertised as anti-inflammatory. It's become a catch-all word that we no longer question. The mistake is not in observing the inflammation or in trying to alleviate it. The mistake is in thinking that inflammation is an answer. It's not. It's a lazy term, an easy out. Inflammation is not spontaneous, nor is it a lone operator. Rather, it's an indicator. What needs our attention are the true underlying causes behind the inflammation. Causes that include the many varieties and strains of Epstein-Barr, shingles, HHV6, other undiscovered strains such as HHV10 and HHV12, and antibiotic-resistant bacteria such as Streptococcus and H. pylori. As we looked at in Chapter 5, Your Symptoms and Conditions Explained, inflammation occurs as a result of invasion and or injury, and these pathogens can cause both. Instead, so-called inflammatory foods get the blame. Grains are a major example, especially in the alternative health community. Grains are pegged as causing inflammation and even creating autoimmune disease itself. The buzzword is mycotoxins, tiny fungi that can infect grain crops. And it's the explanation many sources use for why grains are problematic. The problem with this logic is that plenty of people eat grains and feel fine. How to explain the 90-year-olds who have spent their lives eating grains and processed foods and have never had a health complaint? What's really going on is that those with autoimmune disease have viruses in their bodies, and those bugs feed on the grains and fungi, resulting in inflammation. So someone who's perfectly pathogen-free won't react to grains because the grains don't set off a viral feeding frenzy. Someone with Hashimoto's, Sjogren's, scleroderma, MS or RA, though, will likely feel foggy-headed and fatigued from eating something like bread or bagels. Inflammation is a good start in acknowledging the suffering that people with chronic illness endure. It's a necessary step, just like before the initial pollution in Lake Erie could be addressed. Someone had to first point to the algal bloom. The next step in the path to cleaning up Lake Erie was to question what the algae was communicating, to figure out what was really going on beneath the surface. Instead, inflammation itself remains the medical focus. It used to be that every doctor would have a different opinion about what label to give a patient's observed inflammation. Now, both conventional and alternative medical research and science are stuck in a cycle of testing for levels of inflammation in the body and still playing a guessing game about what to call it. Lupus and psoriatic arthritis are prime examples. You need to know that tests such as erythrocyte sedimentation rate, ESR, C-reactive protein, CRP, and plasma viscosity, PV, immunoglobulin A, IgA, immunoglobulin G, IgG, and anti-nuclear antibodies, ANA, are nowhere near conclusive, and that there is monetary gain to be had for the labs that advertise increasingly advanced inflammation testing. the tests aren't actually able to determine what's wrong with a person. Rather, the labs come up with charts that arbitrarily match different illness names to the different levels of inflammation. This means that merely because your inflammation markers are at a certain level, you could be diagnosed with Lyme disease versus RA. They are, like thyroid tests, merely guess tests, and they use your inflammation against you to put you in a box and give you a label instead of interpreting your inflammation to help you so you can heal. Lately, the charts that labs use to analyze blood test results have started to incorporate pathogen names next to those different levels of inflammation. They do not test for the pathogens themselves, even though they represent that they do. Nor have they identified the true pathogens that correspond with different chronic inflammatory illnesses. The blood lab doesn't tell your doctor it hasn't tested for a pathogen itself, though the doctor assumes it has, and this leads the patient to believe a given pathogen was systematically tested for and located. There's a disconnected relationship between the doctor and the blood lab. This is why you can get tested for Lyme disease and hear that your results are borderline, because the inflammation markers in your blood land on the fringes of a zone where they've listed one or more trendy bacteria that modern medicine mistakenly believes cause Lyme disease. As I revealed in my first book, it's not bacteria that cause Lyme disease. Lyme disease is viral. If this is winding you up right now, please read the Lyme chapter in Medical Medium before you get too upset. Even putting bacterium versus virus aside, if you have any pathogen in your system, no matter what it is, it's either there or it isn't. Yes, as we established in Chapter 7, thyroid guess tests, testing still leaves a lot of room for error, so a pathogen in someone's system may not be detected. If it can be detected, though, there's no in-between. It's not possible that you could be borderline. You either see it or you don't. This means that the Lyme test and others like it that go by inflammation markers are completely unstable. I mention Lyme because it's showing us where this inflammation craze is headed for other chronic illnesses. Inflammation will get all the attention in coming years and obscure the truth that no one's telling you why you're inflamed in the first place. Lyme is such a trendy diagnosis that if a patient has the slightest bit of mystery inflammation caused by any pathogen at all, she or he is likely to get a Lyme diagnosis before the test results have even come back from the lab. Eventually, genes will get the blame for Lyme disease, and countless people will be left feeling like their very essence, their DNA, is to blame for their suffering. It's worth noting that almost everybody who has Lyme disease has a thyroid problem, whether it's been discovered yet or not. That's because, as I said, Lyme is viral. Usually someone with Lyme has multiple viruses at once, and one of those is almost always EBV, which, if it's far enough along to cause Lyme symptoms, has also interfered with thyroid function. This means that it's common to get multiple diagnoses. For example, Hashimoto's, hypothyroidism, Lyme. When in reality, there's only one thing wrong, viral infection, rather than multiple different source problems. Going on an antiviral protocol helps alleviate all of it. When you know that mystery inflammation is not your body destroying itself and creating your illness, that in fact this inflammation is a sign that an invader is present and your body is going after that invader, your whole outlook on your health can change. Rather than pointing to your body as the problem, you can stand confident in the knowledge that there's a greater truth to be discovered about what's causing your chronic symptoms. Stay aware of this great mistake, and you'll be able to protect yourself and your family from the dangers of distraction. Chapter 14. Great Mistake 5. Metabolism Myth. The term metabolism is far outdated. While it may seem like a concept that's well understood by modern science, with massive volumes of data to back it up, the truth is that metabolism refers only to the long-ago discovery that the body is a living organism that assimilates food and uses it for energy. In the several hundred years since this revelation occurred, medicine has not yet cracked the code about why people struggle with their weight, and still the term is offered up as an answer and explanation. One more label that makes people feel like who they are at their core is to blame for their health issues. It's a myth that a slow metabolism is responsible for someone's difficulty losing weight. This concept is like a vintage car that in its day was the height of beauty and sophistication. A car that got you around for years. Over time, though, it got old. It became outdated. Someone parked it in the backyard, where it started to get rusty, the floorboards rotted, the engine seized up. It became a health hazard, as it leaked oil and leached metals into the grass. Only no one could let it go. It was too familiar, held too much sentimental value. The concept of metabolism has been grandfathered into modern medicine from a time when early medical schools were funded and contracted to teach theories like this one. Many of the other great mistakes have been perpetuated for the same reason. Metabolism is a convenient idea to hold on to because it seems to offer patients an explanation for their suffering. Theories like this take on a life of their own, a life so large and dominant that it makes doubters seem like fools for questioning them. If you stop to think about it, though, the metabolism theory is not very scientific, and it has a pretty obvious hole. You can't measure metabolism in a definitive way. Isn't science all about objective measurement? If all we have are crude tests that inaccurately estimate how many calories a person burns, it is impossible to truly measure someone's calorie burn. How can we say with any authority that metabolism is the driving force of mystery weight issues? If solving mystery weight problems were really about eating fewer calories than you burn or measuring your heartbeats per minute, people's problems would already be solved. That advice is so prevalent, everyone's heard it, and so clear-cut that everyone with a weight issue would have followed it and found relief by now. Instead, many people follow calorie counting advice, don't get results, or find the weight comes right back and gets labeled as lazy or told they're not doing it right. So if weight problems aren't just about balancing the calories you consume with the calories you expend, what are they about? In some cases, it has to do with the pituitary gland, the kidney, intestinal issues, or even the heart. An overwhelming amount of the time, weight problems are about the liver and the lymphatic system. When someone is overloaded with toxins in their environment, a diet too high in fat or full of unproductive foods, or, as we looked at in Chapter 5, dealing with a viral issue such as EBV, the liver and lymphatic system become overburdened. They can't detox like they're meant to, and when your body can't detox, then like unwanted houseguests, those toxins stick around, clogging up the works. As a protection mechanism, your body retains fluids to keep the toxins suspended, and the resulting edema translates to weight gain. Instead of investigating and uncovering all this, the easy out that gets no one anywhere is to tell someone it's a slow metabolism. Often thyroid problems are thought to be the underlying reason for chronic weight issues. Maybe you've been told that your hypothyroidism is to blame for that stubborn weight you can't lose, because your underactive thyroid is failing to produce enough metabolism-boosting hormones to keep your weight in check. Don't let this mistaken theory distract you. It's simply another misconception based on the myth that the speed of the metabolism determines someone's ability to control her or his weight. There is literally no such thing as a slow metabolism, so saying that the thyroid is to blame for a slow metabolism just makes the theory more wrong. It's just one more scapegoat, what I call an escape goat, for undiscovered health issues like EBV. The reason weight problems often coincide with thyroid problems is because EBV can cause both separately. It's not a game of dominoes, with EBV knocking into the thyroid, which in turn throws weight off balance. Instead, it's a game of ambush, with EBV advancing to multiple locations in the body, causing problems directly in multiple ways. When people go on thyroid medication, their weight problems don't go away. That's because thyroid hormones don't regulate weight. In fact, people often gain weight on thyroid medication because the liver has to absorb the excess thyroxine from the medication, burdening the organ further. As we looked at in Chapter 8, thyroid medication, the overwhelming majority of people who lose weight on thyroid medication do so because they've changed their diet, exercise, and/or supplementation regimen at the same time. The weight loss isn't because of the thyroid hormones revving up the metabolism. While the thyroid plays a starring role in maintaining the body's homeostasis, and homeostasis is key to your body reaching a balanced weight, the thyroid and the rest of the endocrine system continue to play that role even when the gland is compromised. Finding homeostasis, coming back home in your body, is not about focusing on the thyroid. It's all about detoxing. If you have EBV, it's about getting the virus and its waste matter out of your system and cleansing the toxins and foods that fuel it using the techniques in Part 3. Thyroid resurrection. These techniques are also excellent for cleansing toxins and reorienting your diet to be more liver and lymphatic friendly, even if you don't have EBV. They're not about retreating for a month to do a juice cleanse. They're about finding ways to incorporate detoxing into your daily active life. And they're a world apart from those multivitamins you'll see advertised to support the metabolism. Those ads should say, "This pill will help you find Sasquatch," for how much basis in reality their claims hold. It's important to note that before and after cleansing toxins, your metabolism remains the same. Whether your liver and lymphatic system are sluggish or in top working order, and whether your thyroid is underactive, overactive, or functioning normally, your metabolism continues on autopilot. That's because when we talk about metabolism, all we're really saying is that we're living, breathing human beings with moving body systems. Those who say otherwise, those who say that metabolism explains someone's hunger and weight, don't understand the true causes of chronic symptoms and illness. And that's okay. It's no one's fault, but the old roadmaps of the past. I understand that metabolism may be difficult to accept as a great mistake because it's such a part of our everyday language. That ordinariness, though, is part of what makes it so detrimental. The concept is so accepted, no one feels it can even be questioned with metabolism as part of everyone's vocabulary. It's that much more okay to blame someone for her symptoms, which makes it that much more okay for research to stop looking for the real answers. When you see the metabolism theory for what it is, though, you make a difference in the world. You let go of this heavy baggage, and it frees you up to help someone else see that her weight struggles are not her fault. Chapter 15, Great Mistake 6, Gene Blame Game. If you've dealt with chronic symptoms or conditions like the ones we've looked at in this book, you've probably had the belief drilled into you that your body has let you down, which might well have caused you to feel like you committed some cosmic wrong to deserve this punishment. Blaming chronic illness on your genes, as recent theories do, is yet one more way of reinforcing this sense of guilt. The movement afoot to blame chronic illness on genetics is a classic example of taking a scientific truth, like the fact that we all have DNA and that it plays a profound role in our lives, and then spinning it. Of course, genes are real, and we witness their evidence every day in a father's and son's same smile, in the new baby who got his grandmother's nose, and in the voice answering the telephone that you could swear is your sister and turns out to be your niece. We can't be fooled into thinking genes mean everything. They don't determine our entire lives. Our bodies are geared to be well, and outside factors are what create the slew of chronic issues that hold back so many people. After all, chronic illness has quadrupled in the population over the last 30 years. If we follow the genetic logic, wouldn't that mean that genes have gone bad over the past 3 decades? That doesn't add up. When you're led to believe that you're suffering because your genes are mutated, distorted, bad, or dysfunctional, it creates a powerful message inside the consciousness of your being that can hold back your healing. If you're told that your illness is a fundamental part of you, how are you supposed to have hope for feeling better? Whether your challenge is hypothyroidism, hyperthyroidism, Hashimoto's, Graves, thyroid nodules, cysts, tumours, or another chronic issue, know that your condition is not a judgment on your family line, or who you are as a person, nor is it a prison sentence. Genetics can play a role in illness. However, in the case of autoimmune and other chronic disorders, genes are merely a fraction of a single puzzle piece. There are so many reasons that people get sick that aren't gene-related on any level. While any talk of genetics sounds impressive, don't be fooled. Don't let yourself go down this road of believing you are to blame for your illness. And if you've already gone miles down that dark path during your years of seeking answers, come back to the light. The reason that so many conditions appear to be inherited is that pathogens and pollutants are passed down from parent to child, on top of which family members are often exposed to the same environmental factors simply because they live and travel together. So if both you and your mother suffer from Hashimoto's, it's not because thyroiditis runs in the family, in the traditional understanding of the expression. A more realistic scenario is that your mother contracted EBV at some point in her life before you were born. When you were conceived, she passed this strain of the thyroid virus on to you, and your father passed on ancient mercury inherited from his own parents. Then when you were a small child, you and your mother were both exposed to a pesticide application in your home, which took a toll on your immune systems. And because you and your mother were both under a lot of stress, perhaps due to strained family finances, lived with elevated levels of toxic heavy metals, and ate the same diet of unproductive foods, such as ham omelets and canola fried corn fritters, that virus had a chance to continue to flourish in your livers and eventually your thyroids. Your mother's thyroid problems and other EBV symptoms would have surfaced earlier because she had had the virus for longer. Your health issues would have developed later as the virus moved at its own rate through your body, so it wouldn't have been evident that the two of you were experiencing triggers side by side. Genetics didn't enter into the equation at all. Until medical communities accept the pathogenic and environmental factors involved, they won't be able to assist people in truly recovering from thyroid and other chronic illnesses. This is important to remember in the coming years, As the genetic theory explodes, we haven't seen anything yet when it comes to blaming health problems on the very fiber of one's being. When you come back to this book in 10 years, it will seem like everything you're hearing here is outdated, because genetics will have become the prevailing explanation for chronic health issues. Convincing as it may sound, it won't be the real answer. What you're hearing here will still be far more advanced. Gene blame is a joker's game, where everybody walks away a loser. At the same time that you hear in the future that genes explain everything, if you look around, illness and suffering will be on the rise like never before. Not only will it keep research from pursuing the truth, gene blame itself will be a seed of destruction to immune systems for generations to come. That is, unless the truth in this book gets out. If experts start acknowledging the pathogens and pollutants that are really to blame, only then can true progress be made. For more on the real factors behind illness, see Great Mistake 7, Ignoring the Unforgiving 4. Funding is critical to which way this goes. Look at what funding has done for certain areas of life. Our children today can play the most mind-bogglingly advanced video games, for example, developed by companies flush with capital, while at the same time these kids may suffer from mysterious asthma, acne, other skin conditions, sinus problems, insomnia, celiac disease, stomach aches, anxiety, depression, aches and pains, allergies, even thyroid problems, and a chronic stuffy nose. All issues where the answers are undiscovered, because that's not where the funding is. Genetic funding is huge, because the topic of genetics is an attractive lure. So that's where we see the headlines. One news item you might have read is that genes can be turned on and off, depending on environmental exposures. This theory is not entirely inaccurate. It just doesn't happen to explain chronic illness. When environment plays a role in illness, it's not because the exposure has an effect on a gene, which creates someone's symptoms. It's because the environmental exposure breaks down someone's immune system and feeds viruses such as EBV. As I said, a person gets sick because of an overburdened immune system due to outside factors, whether they're passed down through the bloodline, encountered in the womb, or exposure happens after birth. Whether genes are turned on, off, or sideways, the unforgiving four factors you'll hear about in the next chapter are the real explanation behind the epidemic of chronic illness. The gene world is going to become an unstoppable monster machine that will consume everybody's common sense. And because outside factors are to blame for illness, this means you can protect yourself from them, which was the subject of my book, Medical Medium Life-Changing Foods. Save yourself and the ones you love with the hidden healing powers of fruits and vegetables. The gene blame game, on the other hand, makes people feel like their own destruction comes from within themselves. When someone is suffering from a disease and told it's genetic, it can almost make that person feel like giving up instantly and waiting to hear on the news someday that the cure has been found. This takes them down a darkened, hopeless path, longing for science to someday answer their prayers with a genetic miracle discovery that will never come, because that's not where the real insights await. Think of all the women getting tested to see if they're at genetic risk for breast cancer. The theory that the BRCA1 and the BRCA2 genes are indicators that someone will develop breast cancer is causing women to have double mastectomies, an incredibly painful process, when the truth is that more women without BRCA gene mutations develop breast cancer than women with the gene mutations. Breast cancer is not caused by genes, as we looked at in part one. It is almost always caused by EBV.